Welcome to Stories After Midnight. Today we're going to be reading a couple stories for this video. The first one is called, My New Neighborhood Only Has One Rule, Never, Under Any Circumstances, Help a Lost Pet, by Sohinkter from Reddit. The second story will be, After being estranged from my father for nearly 20 years, someone mailed me his urn. I never should have let that thing into my home, by Unalloyed St. Trina. I hope you enjoy these stories. If you do, let me know in the comments below or wherever you are. And a huge shout out to my patrons for helping make this episode possible. Let's get started. The house was a steal. That should have been the first red flag. A three-bedroom Craftsman with a wraparound porch, for less than the cost of my cramped two-bedroom apartment. It was in a quiet, secluded subdivision called Maple Creek, where all the lawns were impossibly green and the neighbors waved with all five fingers. The HOA president, a woman named Carol, with a smile as bright and hard as a porcelain doll, met me on my first day. She handed me a welcome basket with a bottle of cheap Chardonnay and a single laminated sheet of paper. "We're so glad to have you, Mark," she said, her eyes crinkling in a way that didn't seem genuine. "We're very relaxed here at Maple Creek. We don't have rules about lawn height or fence colors. We only have one." She tapped a perfectly manicured nail on the laminated sheet. On it, in a large, friendly font, were the words, "Rule number one, if you see a pet that appears lost or in distress, do not approach it. Do not feed it. Do not let it into your home. Go inside, lock your doors, and ignore it until it has gone." I laughed, thinking it was a joke. "What, are the raccoons organized crime around here?" Carol's smile didn't waver. "It's not a suggestion, Mark. It's the only thing we require of you. It is for the safety and harmony of the community." Her tone was light, but her eyes were deadly serious. It was the first time I felt a chill in the warm afternoon air. For the first month, it was perfect. Quiet, peaceful. I almost forgot about the bizarre rule. I'd see people walking their dogs on leashes, cats sunning themselves on porches. They were clearly owned, clearly where they were supposed to be. The rule seemed like a weird quirk from a bygone era. Then came the storm last night. It was a real gully washer, with thunder that shook the windows and rain that came down in sheets. It was around midnight when I heard it, a sound that cut through the noise of the storm, a pathetic, high-pitched whine. I peered through my living room window, huddled under the eave of my porch, shivering and soaked. It was a golden retriever. It was beautiful, with big, sad eyes and a leather collar, but no tags. Every time the thunder cracked, it would press itself against my door and cry. My heart broke. The laminated card was sitting on my counter, and Carol's words echoed in my head. "Go inside, lock your doors, and ignore it." But how could I? It was just a dog. A scared, lost animal. What was the worst that could happen? I'd be breaking some stupid arbitrary rule from a power-tripping HOA president? So I did it. I opened the door. The dog practically fell inside, shaking a puddle under my hardwood floor. It looked up at me with such gratitude, nudging its wet head into my hand. I got it a towel and a bowl of water, and it immediately settled down on my rug, letting out a contented sigh. I felt a wave of relief. See? Just a dog. I fell asleep on the couch watching TV. I was woken up a few hours later by a sound that wasn't the storm. Knock, knock, knock. A slow, deliberate knock on my front door. The rain had stopped. The dog on the floor lifted its head, let out a low growl, and then, strangely, trotted to the door, its tail giving a single, lazy wag. I looked through the peephole. Standing on my porch was a man. He was tall, impossibly tall, dressed in a neat old-fashioned suit, like a door-to-door salesman from the 1950s. He was smiling a wide, friendly smile that showed too many teeth, all of them perfectly straight and white. I opened the door a crack, my hand still on the chain. "Can I help you?" "Good evening," the man said, his voice smooth and pleasant. "I do apologize for the late hour. I believe you found my dog." He gestured with his head toward the retriever, who was now sitting patiently at his feet, looking up at him. "Oh, yeah, he was out in the storm," I said, my relief making me feel foolish for ever being scared. "Glad you found him." The tall man's smile widened, stretching his face in a way that felt unnatural. "He has a bit of a habit of getting out. He's a bit of a rascal." He leaned forward, his eyes, dark and unblinking, locking onto mine. "But he's very good at his job." My blood ran cold. "His job?" The man chuckled a dry, rustling sound. He reached down and patted the dog's head. "Of course," he said, his gaze never leaving mine. "His job is to find the kindest person in the neighborhood." He straightened up, his towering frame seeming to block out all the light from the porch. "Thank you so much for your hospitality," the man said, his smile finally reaching his eyes, which now glinted with a terrifying, hungry light. "He likes you very much. He's decided he wants you to meet the rest of his family." My mind screamed at me to slam the door. Slam it, lock it, run. But my body wouldn't obey. I was a statue, my hand frozen on the door. The man's smile never faltered as he gave the door a gentle push. The brass security chain didn't snap or break it. It stretched, elongating like taffy with a soft metallic groan before falling away, limp and useless. "There now," he said pleasantly. "That's better." He didn't enter. He simply took a step back and gestured with an open palm toward the street. It wasn't a command. It was an invitation. And for reasons I can't explain, I found myself stepping out onto the porch. The golden retriever trotted ahead of us, its tail held high. The air was different out here. The storm had washed everything clean, but the world felt muted, like I was looking at it through a pane of smoked glass. The streetlights cast long, distorted shadows that seemed to writhe and twist at the edges of my vision. As we walked, I noticed other things. A sleek black cat emerged from beneath a hedge, its eyes glowing with a faint phosphorescence. It fell into step beside the retriever. A few houses down, a parrot was perched on a mailbox. It didn't squawk or speak. It just swiveled its head, tracking our progress in perfect silence. They were all moving with us, an honor guard of silent, watchful animals. I looked at the houses we passed through their big picture windows. I could see my neighbors. They were frozen in place like mannequins in elaborate dioramas. Our family was sitting around a dinner table, forks raised halfway to their mouths. In another house, a man was stopped mid-stride, one foot hovering over the floor. They were all facing our direction, their faces blank, their eyes wide and vacant. "Don't mind them," the tall man said, noticing my gaze. "They're very good at following the rules." We were heading toward the end of the cul-de-sac, to the oldest house on the block, a large colonial that had been dark and seemingly empty since I'd moved in. As we got closer, I could feel a low vibration through the soles of my shoes, a deep hum that seemed to emanate from the house itself. The golden retriever led the procession up the walkway and sat patiently before the heavy oak door. The other animals formed a silent semicircle behind us, their eyes all fixed on me. The tall man walked to the door. It swung open before he touched it, revealing nothing but a deep and impenetrable darkness inside. The low hum grew louder, resonating in my bones. It sounded like a purr, a gigantic, hungry purr. The man turned to me, his smile as wide and terrifying as ever. He gestured into the blackness. "After you," he said. "They've been looking so forward to this." Story number 2.
"You're sure this thing is for me?"
I asked, studying the smooth red statue that had just been handed over. The young man on my doorstep narrowed his eyes and clenched his jaw, clearly irritated that I wasn't putting an end to this transaction as fast as humanly possible. My question wasn't rhetorical, however, so I met his gaze and waited for an answer. I wasn't about to be pushed around by a kid who probably still needed to borrow his older brother's ID to buy cigarettes. Eventually, the boy released a cartoonishly exaggerated sigh from his lips, conceding to human decency. He looked down at the clipboard, flicking his neck to move a tuft of auburn-colored bangs out of his eyes, to better see the paperwork. Well, is your dad... He paused, flipping through the packet of papers, the edges becoming stained a faint yellow-orange for some unidentified flavor dust that had lingered on his fingertips. I suppressed a gag and continued to smile weakly at the boy, who was appearing younger and younger by the second. Adrian... Redacted. Yes, that's my father's name, but I haven't spoken to him in nearly 20 years. He chuckled and flipped the paperwork back to the front sheet. Well, consider this a family reunion then, lady, because you're holding them. Truthfully, I was a little flabbergasted. Adrian and I had been estranged for 2 decades. No awkward phone call at Thanksgiving, no birthday card arriving in the mail 3 weeks late, complete and total radio silence starting the moment I left my hometown for greener pastures. He hadn't even bothered to reach out after the birth of my only son 5 years ago. I'm fairly confident he was aware of Davy's birth, too. My deadbeat sister still kept up with him, and she knew about my son. So as I further inspected the strange effigy, I found myself asking, why weren't Dad's ashes bequeathed to Victoria instead? Sure, she only used him for his money. To my sister, Adrian was a piggy bank with a heartbeat that she shared some genetics with. But at least she actually talked to the man. The decision to have this mailed to me upon his demise was inherently perplexing. I rolled the idol in my palm, feeling the wax drag over my skin. There was a subtle heat radiating from the object, akin to the warmth of holding a lit candle. But this thing sure wasn't a candle, I reflected. It was an urn. The acne-ridden burlap sack of hormones that had been coating my property with Cheetos residue, like soot after the eruption of Pompeii, banged a pen against the clipboard. Lady, can you and Pop-Pop catch up later? You know, like, when I'm not here? I wanted nothing more than to knock the teeth out of his crap-eating grin, but he could hear Davy behind me, tapping the tip of an umbrella against the screen door, giggling and trying to get my attention. As a single parent, I was his only role model. Punching the lights out of a teenager, I contemplated, probably wouldn't be a great behavior to model. With a calculated sluggishness, I picked up the pen and produced my signature on the paperwork. I took my sweet time, much to his chagrin. As soon as I dotted the last I, the kid ripped the clipboard from me and turned away, stomping off to his beat-up sedan parked on the curb. "Wash your hands, champ!" shouted after him. Once he had sped away, the car's sputtering engine finally fading into nothingness, I basked in the quiet of the early evening, chirping insects, a whistling breeze, and little else. The perpetual lullaby of sleepy suburbia. That silence made what Davy said next exceptionally odd.
Mommy, it's too loud. It's really loud, he proclaimed, dropping the umbrella on the floor, pacing away from the screen door with his hands cupped over his ears.
I spun around, red effigy still radiating warmth in my palm, listening intently, searching for the noise my son was complaining about. But there was nothing. The shrill chiming of our landline greeted me as I walked into the house, screen door swinging closed behind me. I suppose now is a good time to mention this all occurred in the late 90s, i.e., no cell phones. At least, I didn't have the money to afford one back then. That must be the noise Davy was upset about, I thought. Logically, though, that didn't make a lick of sense. He'd never objected to the sound of the phone ringing before, not once. I slapped the red effigy on the kitchen table, rushing to put it down so I could answer the call before it went to voicemail. Hello?
Oh, hey, Alice. For a second I was convinced you weren't going to pick up, since you've been dodging my calls, I mean.
My heart sank as Victoria's nasal-toned voice sneered through the receiver. I shut my eyes and leaned my head against the kitchen wall, lamenting the choice to answer this call.
I haven't been dodging your calls, sweetheart. Being a single mom is a bit time-consuming, and I don't really have anything new to tell you. I can't repay you overnight.
A few months prior, Davy had been hospitalized with pneumonia, and I was between employment, which meant we had no insurance, and were paying the medical bills out of pocket. With limited options and against my better judgment, I asked my sister for a loan. Honestly, I would have been better off indebted to the Yakuza. And at least when you're unable to pay them, they'll accept a pinky finger as reimbursement. According to the movie I watched, at least.
Okay, sweetheart, well, that's all well and good, but if you don't pay up soon, Child welfare services may get an anonymous call. A concerned citizen worried about Danny's safety in your home.
I didn't bother correcting her, for obvious reasons. If she were to ever make good on that threat, Victoria, not even knowing my son's name, would only bolster my chances at convincing social services that she was a heartless witch, not a concerned citizen. So instead, I pulled my head from the wall and opened my eyes, about to hang up on her. Right before I placed the phone on the receiver, however, the sight of the red effigy in my peripheral vision captured my attention. I held the phone in the air, hearing distant, static-laden hellos from Victoria as I stared at the object. Despite harboring my father's ashes inside its waxen confines, the figure sort of resembled a woman. It was hard to know for certain, although it had the frame of a human being. The idol was mostly featureless, sleek and burgundy like red wine frozen into the shape of a person. No face, no hair, no clothes. That said, its wide hips and narrow shoulders gave it a feminine appearance, hands clasped together in a prayer-like gesture over its chest, almost resembling a statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Gazing at it so intensely eventually caused a massive shiver to explode down the length of my spine, clunky but forceful, like a rock slide. In spite of that sensation, I was transfixed. I creeped over to the idol, on my tiptoes, as if I didn't want it to hear me approach, phone still in hand. It was remained inexplicably hot to the touch as I picked it up. For a moment, I regretted signing the ominous delivery. At the same time, what was I supposed to do? Reject my father's ashes? Even though we were estranged, that just felt wrong. As I better inspected the urn, though, my regret only became more acute. First off, there was no lid or cap to the damn thing. I assumed there would be a cork on the bottom or something, but that surface was just as smooth as the rest of it. So how did the ashes get inside? Not only that, but when I tilted the effigy upside down, desperately searching for exactly where my father's ashes had been inserted into the mold, an unexpected noise caused me to nearly jump out of my skin. It rattled. My father's supposedly cremated remains rattled. Rising fear resulted in me clumsily hurling the thing back down. If I'm remembering correctly, I basically lobbed it at the table like a softball pitch. Despite that, it didn't roll across the surface. It didn't break into a few pieces or tumble on the floor. In a singular motion, it landed perfectly upright. Somehow, the base of the effigy stuck to the table like it had been magnetized to its exterior. I slowly lifted the phone back to my ear. "You still there, Vic?" I asked, whispering. "Yeah, damn, I'm still here. Where'd you go? I was totally kidding before, Alice. You know that. I do really need that money, though. Made some really crappy bets." Cutting her off before the inevitable tangent, I whispered another question. "Have you talked to Dad recently?" The line went dead. I listened to the thumping of Davey moving around in his room directly above me as I waited for a reply. Eventually, she responded, her tone laced with the faintest echoes of fear. "Maybe like a year ago? Since then, nothing. Why? You never ask about Dad. You finally reach out to him or something?" Briefly, I considered answering, explaining in no uncertain terms the uncanniness of the urn that was now haunting my kitchen table. But somehow, I knew I shouldn't. To this day, I can't decipher the reasoning behind my intuition. Call it an extrasensory premonition or the gut instincts of a mother, but I held my tongue. That decision likely saved mine and my son's life. I hung up without another word. It began to ring again immediately, but I ignored it. Ignored it a second and third time, too. I stood motionless in front of the landline, waiting for Victoria to give up. After the fifth unanswered call, the room finally went silent. Once a minute had passed without another ring, I felt confident that she was done extorting me, for the time being at least. Shaking off my nervous energy with a few shoulder twists, I walked out of the kitchen, down the hallway, until I reached the stairs and shouted up to Davey, "Honey, come down and help me with dinner." I heard my son erupt from his bedroom, slamming the door behind him, sneakers tapping against the floorboards as he ran. When he came into view, grinning excitedly, I painted a very artificial smile on my face, masking my smoldering apprehension for his benefit.
Before his foot even touched the first stair, however, his grin evaporated, replaced by a deep frown alongside a shimmer of profound worry behind his eyes. Once again, he cupped his hands over his ears and screamed down at me. "Mom, it's still too loud. The man is laughing and dancing so loud. Can you please tell him to stop?" The curves of my artificial smile began to falter and fade, despite my attempt to maintain the facade of normality. Other than my son's deafening words, the house was completely silent, devoid of any and all sound. And there was only one thing that was different. In another example of unexplainable intuition, I marched into the kitchen, picked up the effigy plus the certificate that it came with, and walked down into the cellar, ignoring the eerie heat simmering in my palm. I made my way to the darkest corner of the unfinished basement and placed my father's rattling ashes behind a stack of winter coats. By the time I returned to the kitchen, Davy was already there, rummaging through the pantry. "All better, love bug?" He paused, scavenging for a second, perking his ears.
"Pretty much. I can still hear him giggling, but it doesn't hurt my head. Can we have spaghetti for dinner?"
That was the worst of it for a few months. Without Davy complaining about the volume of the laughing, dancing man, I forgot about the effigy. Make all the comments you want about my lack of supernatural vigilance, call me a moron or brain dead, it's okay. I've called myself all of those things and much, much more 1,000 times over since these events. I was a single mom working 2 jobs, protecting and raising my kid the best I knew how. Credit where credit is due, though. I caught on before it was too late. It started with the ants. In the weeks prior to the delivery of the red effigy, our home had become overrun with tiny black invaders, and I couldn't afford to hire an exterminator. Instead, I settled for the much cheaper option, ant traps. At first, I thought I was wasting my money, but I didn't seem to be making a dent in the infestation. Then, out of nowhere, the ants disappeared without a trace. Some kind of noiseless extinction event apparently took place without me noticing. Maybe the traps did work, just took some time, I thought. Then, one night, I was bending over at the fridge, selecting a midnight snack. As I grabbed some leftovers, the dim, phosphorescent glow coming from the appliance highlighted subtle movements by the cellar door. I stood up and squinted at the movement, but I couldn't tell what the hell it was. Honestly, it looks like some invisible person was drawing a straight line in pencil between the back door and the entrance to the basement, obsidian graphite dragging against the tile floor. I rubbed the sleep from my eyes, but the bizarre phenomena didn't change. When I flicked the kitchen light on, I better understood what was happening, but I had no clue why it was happening. A steady stream of black ants were silently making their way into the cellar. More irritated than frightened in that moment, I traced their cryptic migration down the creaky stairs, assuming they had been attracted to some food Davy absentmindedly left down there. But when I saw that the procession of living dots were heading for the area behind the winter coats, the irritation spilled from my pores with the sweat that was starting to drench my t-shirt, and then fear was the only emotion left inside me. I hadn't thought about the red effigy in some time. As I peeked behind the stack of fleeces and windbreakers, I almost didn't recognize it. It had tripled in size. The figure wasn't praying anymore either. Now it was lying in the fetal position, knees tucked to its chest, head resting on the ground. Ants entered the wax, but they didn't come out. One by one, they gave their bodies to the red effigy. As my horror hit a fever pitch, vibrating in my chest like a suffocating hummingbird, I could have sworn the idol tilted its smooth, featureless face to glare at me. I swung around and bolted up the stairs. Didn't sleep much that night. Not a wink after what I witnessed in the cellar. I paced manic laps around the first floor of my home all through the night, desperately trying to process the encounter. As the sun rose, however, I hadn't figured much out. I wasn't convinced what I saw was real. If it was real, God forbid, I had no idea what to do about it. Exhausted to where I became fearless and dumb, I plodded the stairs, snow shovel in hand, determined to throw my father's supposedly incinerated corpse into the garbage. The morning light pouring in through a dusty window near the ceiling made the process exponentially less terrifying, at least at first. When I reached the idol, I came to the gut-wrenching conclusion that I hadn't hallucinated its transformation. It was still the size of a toddler.
I didn't dwell on the unexplainable, but that would have paralyzed me to the point of catatonia. Instead, I have focused my attention solely on getting that red curse out of my damn house. I arched back with the shovel and slid it under the wax. Briefly, I stopped, readying myself to sprint out of the cellar and breakneck speed if the effigy came to life in response to my intrusion. It remained inanimate, and I cautiously placed my hands back on the handle, attempting to lift the wax idol. Attempting and failing to lift it. No matter how hard I tried, no matter how much energy I put into the action, it wouldn't budge. I couldn't move it an inch. Dumbfounded, I let the shovel clatter to the floor and left the cellar to get Davy ready for school. Locked the door behind me, just in case. Over the next week, I enlisted 3 separate men, each of them strapping and Herculean in their own right, to help me try to move the blossoming urn. Instructing them not to touch it, another baseless intuition that turned out to be correct when I was put to the test. My ex-boyfriend couldn't lift it with a shovel, and he was able to bench press 400 pounds. My plumber, a person I'd been friendly with for years, couldn't lift it either. When he tried to push the idol as opposed to lifting it with a shovel, the grizzled man screamed bloody murder, having sustained third-degree burns on the inside of both hands from the attempt. My pastor wouldn't even go into the cellar. He gripped the golden cross around his neck as he peered into the depths, quivering and wide-eyed, told me I needed someone to exorcise the property as he jogged out the door. I asked him if he knew any such person, but he said nothing and continued on jogging. In a moment of obscene bravery, I went into the cellar by myself and retrieved the certificate that came with the idol. If strength wasn't the answer, then I needed a more cunning approach. Figured reviewing the documentation that came with it was a good place to start. There wasn't much to review, however. The certificate barely had anything on it other than my father's name. As I stared at the piece of paper, trying to will an epiphany into existence, I noticed something that caused my heart to drop into my stomach like a cannonball. Although I made it manifest, the epiphany didn't help me much in the end, unfortunately. My father's middle initial was T, but the paper listed his middle initial as L. All the men on my dad's side of my family were named Adrian, as it would happen. If their certificate was to be believed, this wasn't my father's ashes. It was my great-grandfather's ashes. The last night Davy and I stayed in that house, I jolted awake to the sound of my son shrieking from somewhere below me. Ever since I discovered the red effigy had grown, he had been sleeping in my bedroom right next to me. My son wasn't in bed when I heard the wails, so I launched myself upright, sprinting toward the cellar. If I had been paying more attention, I may have noticed the light under the closed bathroom door that I passed on my way there. Seconds later, I was at the bottom of the basement stairs. I flipped the cellar light on, but the bulb must have burnt out because nothing happened. In the darkness, I could faintly see Davy kneeling over the red effigy, screaming in pain. Before I could even think, I was across the room, reaching out my hand to grab my son's shoulder and pull him away from it. When I heard another noise from behind me, instantly I halted my forward motion, fingertips hanging inches above the shadow-cloaked figure I assumed was my son. "Mom! Mom! Who's screaming?" Davy shouted from the top of the cellar stairs. My brain struggled to process the bombardment of sensations, emotions, and conflicting pieces of information. I lingered in that position, statuesque and petrified, until an onslaught of searing agony wrenched me from my daze. As my eyes adjusted to the darkness, I could see 2 shapes in front of me, and neither of them were Davy. There was the idol, still curled into the fetal position, and then there was the thing I was leaning over, which was just the thin silhouette of a child's head and shoulders, without any other body parts. Connected to the idol by a waxy thread that had been hidden from view by the pile of coats. A tendril had grown from the silhouette's head and was now enveloping the ring and middle fingers of my outstretched hand. Never in my life have I experienced a more devastating pain. With all the force I could muster, I threw myself backward. There were the sickening snaps of tendons accompanied by the high-pitched crunching of knuckles. And then my spine hit the ground hard. Both of my fingers had been torn off, absorbed into the wax, leaving 2 bleeding stumps on my hand,
fragments of bone jutting out of the ruptured flesh like marble gravestones. Adrenaline, thankfully, is an astounding painkiller. By the time I had scooped up Davey and put him in the car and started accelerating away from that house, I didn't feel a thing anymore. While I was being treated for my injuries at the hospital, I contemplated what to do next. My fear was that this thing wanted specifically me or my son and wouldn't settle for someone else. So even if I moved me and Davey across the country, jumping from shelter to shelter, would that really be enough? Would we ever truly be safe? In the end, I'm sort of grateful that the idol ingested those two fingers. Being with Davey in the same hospital that had treated him for pneumonia reminded me of my debt, and that gave an idea. If the red effigy wanted us, maybe I could offer it a close second. Once I had been stitched up, I picked up the phone and called Victoria. "Hey, I have a proposition for you. I'll give you the house as compensation for my debt. As long as you throw in a few grand on top, you can easily sell it for 20 times that, you know." Never heard from Victoria again after I traded the deed for cash. Davey and I moved across the country, starting fresh in a new city. No surprise deliveries at our new home for over 20 years, either, until now. Today is my birthday, and I received something in the mail. The return address is our old home. With trembling hands, I peeled the letter open and removed the card that was inside. Here's what the message said. "Dear Alice, I apologize about not reaching out after all these years. Truthfully, I imagined you'd still be angry at me and Granddad, but I'm hoping you'll get this card and let bygones be bygones. I want you to know that Victoria was my first choice for the urn. However, at the time, she owed me a great deal of money. To avoid payment, your sister convinced me she was in prison, which made her an unsuitable choice for what I would expect are obvious reasons after what happened to your fingers. In the end, however, I suppose it all worked out as it was meant to be. Please call. I look forward to the four of us spending time together. Happy birthday, Dad." Attached, there's a Polaroid of my father and another man standing next to him. Dad looks exactly as I remember him when I left home, and that was almost half a century ago. And the other man looks a lot like him. Davey is away at college. He hasn't answered my calls for the last 2 days. Once I post this, I suppose I'll call my father. Wish me luck. And that's the end of these stories. I hope you enjoyed them. Let me know what you thought in the comments below, wherever you are. Huge shout out once again to my patrons for helping make this episode possible. And thank you for choosing this story or collection of stories to listen to. I appreciate you for checking them out. And I think that's all I have to say. Hey, why don't you like this video? Why don't you like this episode of wherever you're listening? And give it a big thumbs up. And let me know if you think pineapple belongs on pizza, or if the people who do like pineapple on pizza should be put in jail for committing war crimes.